Good evening, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Data and Perspectives, as tonight we explore the role of PARP inhibitors in four common cancers. We have a really outstanding faculty here today. Dr. Hussein is going to focus on prostate cancer, Dr. Matalonis, ovarian cancer, Dr. Philip, pancreatic cancer, and Dr. Rugo, breast cancer. Here's where we're heading tonight. We're going to spend some time in the beginning, talk a little bit from a macro perspective about PARP inhibitors in terms of the biology, mechanism of action, side effects, and then we're going to explore briefly kind of where things are with these four cancers and try to compare notes a little bit. This is the second time we've juxtaposed investigators in different tumor types for this topic, and the first time was really interesting. I know this time will be as well. So Versa, just to start out a little bit about some general issues in terms of assays, biopsies, and mechanism of action. So Philip, maybe, and I should mention that I met individually with each of the four faculty members for about an hour. We recorded a presentation that goes through all the data and a lot of the subtleties with each of these cancers. We'll let you know when that's posted as part of this whole package. But Philip, in your talk, you showed this slide talking a little bit about mechanisms of action. Can you comment on it, Philip?
So basically, this is the principle of synthetic lethality, where you're exploiting a defect in DNA repair in the cancer cell, in this case, BRCA mutation, and you're using that to really inactivate completely the ability of the cell to get salvaged by the PARP, and therefore you're inhibiting the PARP. The PARP inhibitor in this case will lead to the demise of the cancer cell. However, the normal cell, which doesn't have that normal cells will be different because they will be affected differently. And this is not only done by PARP inhibitors, but also by the DNA damaging agents, which we'll come back to it later on.
So, Hope, maybe you can talk a little bit about the PARP inhibitors that are out there. There are five that we have a lot of data on, four of which are approved. Can you talk about your vision of how they differ?
That's a really interesting question. I think that we don't have direct comparisons in clinical trials. So we're making assessments based on cross-trial comparisons, as well as a little bit on potency of PARP trapping, where talazoparib is the most potent PARP trapper, and olaparib, and then niraparib, rucaparib, and veliparib. And interestingly, in breast cancer, you can combine veliparib with chemotherapy without the same kind of hematologic toxicity that you see with, for example, olaparib or talazoparib, where it's been very, very difficult. So there does seem to be some intrinsic difference. What that means clinically, we don't understand yet.
So Ursula, I'm curious about your take on this and also a little bit more about some of the mechanisms involved and how these agents work.
So, you know, as Hope just mentioned, veliparib is the weakest PARP trapper. And I think it's, you know, to date has had the least promising results for ovary cancer. You know, we use niraparib, rucaparib, and olaparib. Talazoparib is the strongest PARP trapper. But I think for the three that we use in ovary cancer, there's higher PARP trapping with niraparib, but if you look at results for using these drugs as maintenance therapy for recurrent disease, that's where we've got the most comparison. They really appear to perform very, very similarly. So I think that from a efficacy standpoint, olaparib, niraparib, and rucaparib are quite equivalent, with veliparib being sort of an outlier, and we can see that in clinical trials. It's this lack of robustness.
Of course, I guess the issue there is the ability to combine with chemotherapy, Ursula, but I guess at this point, at least we haven't had an approval with that.
That's correct. The VELIA trial that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, presented at ESMO, is still under review. And I think, again, when you compare that trial in the upfront setting compared to the PRIMA study and PAOLA 1, it has the least impressive results, and it's really only when you use veliparib as not just with chemotherapy, but use it as maintenance, where you see the difference. When the arm that looks at veliparib with chemotherapy and then no maintenance is the same essentially as chemotherapy, as carboplatin paclitaxel.
So Maha, we see the approval now of two PARP inhibitors in prostate cancer and a couple others where there's some interesting data. Any comments in general, Maha, right now about sort of where these agents are being used in the management of prostate cancer?
So like any new drug, when it's in development, we start at pretty much close to end stage disease and we begin to gradually move it up. And prostate cancer, obviously, the phase 3 trial that was done with olaparib was, if you look at the data, it's almost second, third, fourth line because patients would have been treated by multiple lines of therapy. I think what I think is going to be exciting is to begin to look at moving treatments into the earlier stages of the disease. And there are definitely trials right now that are going on in the frontline castration-resistant prostate cancer. It'll be interesting to see how the data would compare. What we know is, generally speaking, for most of the diseases, most of the agents that we use, earlier appears to be better. It'll be interesting to see how the story will play with the PARP inhibitors, because in fact, unlike breast and pancreatic and ovarian, this is the first targeted therapy type agent in prostate cancer. And we're sort of getting our hands dirty, so to speak, and trying to figure out how to best navigate the pathway. There's going to be emerging data on some of the additional analyses that we are doing with the PROFOUND trial that I think will add some insights into things. I cannot comment on them right now, but we'll add some insights.
I have heard people say that endocrine therapy is targeted therapy. So from that point of view, I guess endocrine therapy might be the oldest form of targeted therapy. We actually started this company in 1985 on tamoxifen.
Yeah.
So, you know, here we are.
You're absolutely correct. The only difference is one thing about AR and perhaps more so than, say, the estrogen receptor. AR is so dominant in prostate cancer in the vast majority of men. And so consequently, because if you treat 100 patients, 99 will likely to respond, we have not gotten into the measurement of AR to determine which patient are you going to use AR-targeted therapy for.
That's a really good point. So, Philip, I'm just kind of curious, when you look at these four cancers, you know, how you think about sort of the BRCA-ness or the DNA repair-ness of the four, and really where pancreatic fits in terms of that quality and, let's say, sensitivity to PARP inhibitors compared to the others, Philip.
So, Maha said that we had other target agents in pancreatic. In fact, we don't have. This will be our first one, if you consider the immunotherapy in MSI high patients. So DNA repair defects have been seen in approximately 10 to 15% of the patients with or tumors with pancreatic cancer. And at this point in time, we have the BRCA1 and 2, but there are other deficiencies like ATM, PALB2, and a few others. It's hard to say whether it's much different than other cancers. I think the DNA repair pathways are deficient in across cancers. It's probably a bit more generic than we think. So I personally think that in pancreatic cancer, we're seeing the same biology, similar biology. The problem is that we may not have the same response to the PARP inhibitors as we see in other tumors. And we're waiting for the maintenance trials, which are, for example, in adjuvant setting, to really help us more to decide that.
Ursula, what's your take on that? Where do you see ovarian cancer fit in? You know, we sit back here, we listen to all of you and kind of see, I try to make my own hypothesis. It kind of seems like ovarian is more, you know, there's more DNA damage going on there, just the way that it presents phenotypically. Is that your take?
Absolutely. And I think you sort of hit the nail on the head in terms of the responsiveness of high-grade serous ovarian cancer to platinum. So pre-platinum, you know, in the 60s, you know, women would really succumb to high-grade serous ovarian cancer quite quickly. With the institution of platinum, I mean, that has been a huge step forward. And obviously, PARP inhibitors with its interaction and effect on DNA repair is crucial. So of high-grade serous ovarian cancer, which is the most common subtype of epithelial ovarian cancer, half, 50%, have underlying homologous recombination deficiency. 22% of all high-grade serous have underlying BRCA1 and 2 mutations. So it is a heavily rich tumor in HRD.
So I want to bring in now the issue of side effects and toxicity, and then we'll start looking at how it kind of plays out in these different cancers. But Maha, this is kind of a weird question I thought about last year. I never thought about it until I got the four groups together. But here's a statement. You tell me whether you agree or disagree, Maha. Patients with germline BRCA mutations who get a PARP inhibitor have more cytopenias than those without BRCA mutations, often require dose adjustment. And I think sort of underlying this also is really kind of the mechanism of how PARP inhibitors really work, because I think the answer to this question would be that there's not more toxicity seen BRCA germline. Maha, can you comment on that?
I am going to choose the answer of I don't know yet.
Oh,
and
okay.
I have to say, because...
Well, that's a good one.
Well, remember, we're sort of the new kid on the block in prostate cancer. So clearly, I think there are variations in different potential disease settings, different tumors. But I should say in PROFOUND, we do have some data on germline. So I think this would be a very good point to look at. As far as I can tell, there is not a clear glaring signal at this moment. From my experience with my patients, I don't see that there's a signal one way or another at this moment.
Hope, I was really bringing this point up also in terms of sort of the mechanism and the biology and the fact that you need another hit in order to get toxicity. Maybe you can comment on that.
You know, I think I have to agree with Maha. I agree with you. It seems like you should see differential toxicity if you have a germline BRCA mutation or not, or even a somatic mutation, because, you know, you really have one area where you can't repair DNA, you're blocking the other, so you would see more systemic toxicity of all sorts that are related to repairing DNA. And we think about bone marrow toxicity, of course, the cells are being made very rapidly and can be destroyed. It takes a little while to recover them. But what's interesting is I don't know that we've really seen that. And I don't know, certainly in breast cancer, we don't have a lot of patients who've been treated who don't have germline mutations with which to look at. But in those small number of patients, we really have not seen a standout of different toxicity, even though it would make sense theoretically, which is common in medicine. What makes sense to us theoretically doesn't often pan out in the clinic. You know, the people who don't have BRCA mutations, we're giving them chemo. Right, we were talking about veliparib. There may be something about a weak PARP inhibitor where it enhances the effect of chemotherapy in patients who have homologous recombination defects, but you're not going to see that benefit in patients with germline mutations. In that group, even that group, we're not really clear that there's a differential hematologic toxicity.
So thinking about the old days when we used to get together physically and actually have meetings and we do poll questions, I used to always love it when we put up a question and say, what do you do? And we'd see five different things and you know that everybody was in agree. I love the answers to this one, though. This question, 25% agree, 25% disagree, and 50% don't know. So that's perfect. But I don't think we're going to find... I don't think we'll find that level of disagreement with this next question. And Ursula, which is, you know, in the beginning, we started to hear a lot about one PARP inhibitor does one thing, one does the other. The more I started to listen to you all talk, the more I started to hear, you know, that these are really class effects. So anyhow, Ursula, we put this question together to see what the audience, whether there's a consensus. This one looks like we're going to get a little more consensus, but the statement is that GI side effects and cytopenias are class effects of PARP inhibitors. But the frequency varies among available agents. I think clearly gynecologic oncologists and gynecologic oncology has had the greatest experience with this at this point. Ursula, what are your comments and thoughts?
Yeah, no, I agree with the audience. They said agree. GI side effects, fatigue, pancytopenia are all class effects of PARP inhibitors. And each drug has different... different sort of toxicities, sort of frequency of toxicities in each of those categories. So if there's a patient who, for example, has significant nausea, vomiting on one drug, you could potentially switch over to another. because I do think that they have very similar efficacy, at least the three that we use in ovarian cancer. Some of that side effects, such as certainly nausea, some GI effects should get better with time. And study 19, we looked at this, and you know, over a month or two being on the drug, these side effects tend to get better. Fatigue is going to be an issue for patients. And then cytopenias clearly have to be monitored very closely. You know, the FDA package inserts have clear specifications about how to monitor patients, how frequently a complete blood count should be obtained.
So I hope I was actually interviewing your nurse earlier today for a nursing program. She was presenting a case that I guess she shared with you. This patient went back and forth between olaparib and telazoparib. He kept having problems with both. Can you comment a little bit at this point, Hope, on what your experience is with these two agents, and particularly from the point of view of tolerability, what you're seeing?
You know, again, these are anecdotes in many ways, and we have the cross-trial comparisons, of course, which are limited as well in different patient populations. So I think that, you know, what we understand is we're seeing issues with anemia. Thrombocytopenia is much less common with olaparib and talazoparib mm-hmm. than it might be with potentially niraparib. But of course, that depends somewhat on the previous treatment that patients have received. You know, we really, although I see highlighted here the liver enzyme elevation, we don't really see that in clinical practice. I think that what's limiting to us are the anemia, some degree fatigue, nausea, and headache, interestingly. So some patients really are plagued with headache, although it's a smaller percentage of patients. And those are really the toxicities we deal with. I talk to patients a lot about managing this and using preventive medications. For example, we use olanzapine a lot at bedtime, the antipsychotic, which is now in the NCCN guidelines for nausea. And that works out well because you can take it at bedtime and it lasts the whole day. We use dose reductions. The particular patient that my nurse practitioner was talking about also has a childhood, you know, type 1 diabetes. And I don't know what role it played, but she really had significant anemia after completing radiation for metastatic disease. Dose reduced, still had a lot of anemia, went on olaparib. The anemia went away, she started throwing up. So then eventually we went back to the talazoparib a long time afterwards, and she took the talazoparib without the same degree of anemia. So I don't know. You know, this is, again, I was interested about Ursula talking about adjusting to toxicity, and some people do and some people don't.
So it's interesting you mentioned headache. I never heard about headache as a side effect until I heard about acalabrutinib, and the BTK inhibitor, where for some reason caffeine makes it go. But everybody says the same thing. I don't know if it was in a trial, but they all say the same thing. Philip, one more comment, and we're going to start going through the various cancers in terms of toxicity, what you see with pancreatic cancer, and particularly whether or not you see more problems with GI toxicity. You know, I wonder if some of these things have to do with the setting that's occurring. We know that pancreatic cancer patients have a lot of intra-abdominal problems. They already have GI symptoms. Philip, how do the PARP inhibitors work in that setting? I kind of actually heard that they don't really cause a huge problem.
That has been our experience for sure. Whether we're really prepared for GI side effects because of the type of the subspecialty we're in, that's a very likely possibility. Or it could be that we may not be treating them as long as the others are doing. But certainly in GI, in pancreatic cancer, we are seeing not much of a dose-limiting or limiting toxicities attributed to the GI tract. I agree.
So I was thinking about the fact that we as a CME group have done CME programs on PARP and breast cancer, PARP and, you know, all of these. And now we're kind of trying to bring them together in a short period of time. But we just kind of want to run through kind of the role that it's playing in these four diseases. We're going to start out talking about ovarian cancer, which of course has the biggest lead and, you know, really having a big, big effect in this disease right now. And in particular, four major phase three trials that have come out over the last couple of years that have really changed the way we approach this. So we're going to try to go through several aspects of this. One, the genomic profile, the genomic workup, and what the trials have showed initially in relapse disease and more recently now in patients who have upfront treatment with either neoadjuvant therapy or debulking surgery. So a couple of questions just to kind of get warmed up. Maybe I'll see if Hope wants to answer this one, because it's an ovary patient case. So we're saying PARP inhibitors should be offered or discussed as an option, phase 3 and 4 ovarian cancer in every patient, regardless of profile. Hope, what do you think?
Well, you know, my data from this comes for listening to the plenary sessions at ESMO, when we had this, you know, unbelievable plenary session with both the MONARCH data, but also the niraparib data.
Right.
Where there was a benefit in all patients. And I think that, you know, the benefit is clearly greater in patients with germline BRCA mutations or somatic mutations. But I think that there is a chance of a small benefit in all patients. So given the fact that outcome is kind of crummy in those patients, I would answer yes.
So it looks like a majority of the audience also agrees with you in that respect. We have another question, which is about veliparib. We were talking about that, and one of these trials looked at veliparib in combination with chemotherapy. And so we asked this question. So patient with stage 3 ovarian cancer, adding veliparib to induction chemo and then continuing it as maintenance results in similar outcomes to the other trials looking at, you know, other agents, specifically niraparib and olaparib. And Ursula, you kind of commented on this, the fact that maybe indirectly it's not quite as great, but it kind of seems like it's in enough of the ballpark. Do you think this is going to actually get approved, Ursula?
That's a good question. I think, you know, it may get approved, but the question is, are we going to use the drug? You know, it used a different HRD score compared to Prima and Paola, which used the HRD score of 42. This was a much lower HRD score, so trying to encompass more patients. You know, they're all high-grade serous. The issue is, you know, when patients went on the VELIA trial, because they received the PARP inhibitor with the chemotherapy, there's no kind of distillation of patients who are going to benefit the most, you know, those who are really HRD, high-grade serous, and in response to chemotherapy, which is a key component of the FDA approval for niraparib and for olaparib. It's a weaker PARP trapper. Secondly, it used a different HRD score. And then thirdly, you don't really have a way of weeding out those patients and kind of selecting them for true HRD in response to chemotherapy.
Anyhow, I skipped the question, but the audience answered it anyhow about bevacizumab, but we're going to get into that in a second. But we also conducted a survey in the last couple of weeks of 75 general medical oncologists in community-based practice. We're going to show you the results of that survey in terms of, you know, indicating kind of what people are doing. Here's one question we asked Ursa, which is, how do you approach mutation testing? Patient presents with ovarian cancer and no specific family history. And I guess what we've been hearing, and it looks like the oncologists are getting the message, Ursula, is that you need for sure, germline BRCA, but I think what we're hearing more and more is BRCA is germline panels and somatic panels, somatic NGS. Ursula, it looks like that's what's happening in the community, and I think that's kind of what's happening in the investigator community.
Yeah, I think as soon as somebody walks through the door with a diagnosis of ovarian cancer, regardless of stage, family history, and histology, they should undergo genetic testing for germline with a panel test. And then at Dana-Farber, we're also doing somatic NGS as well. Yeah, and this has really been nicely detailed in the updated ASCO genetic guidelines. Panos Konstantinopoulos, one of my colleagues, was the first author, which really basically says every patient who we should be testing all these patients. It's important for informing family members so we can prevent this cancer from happening through risk-reducing surgery, and it also has an impact on treatment.
And we know in ovary, Philip, that if you just do a germline panel, you're going to miss a few patients. And if you just do NGS, you're going to miss a few patients. And just kind of curious right now, again, metastatic pancreatic cancer, Philip, in terms of workup, germline and somatic testing, same as ovary or different?
So it's clear from the NCCN guidelines and other guidelines that have been published over the last 12 months that we have to do the germline testing in every newly diagnosed patient with pancreatic cancer, for the reason that some of those patients who have mutations may not have any family history. In fact, half of the mutation carrier did not have family history. In terms of the NGS, it depends. I myself, I do NGS on every single newly diagnosed patient, especially with advanced disease. But the problem is not always you can get enough tissue to do the NGS because of like final aspirates, et cetera, which are commonly done still, especially with patients, for example, with the localized disease. So in summary, we have to do germline on every patient newly diagnosed, irrespective of stage, and NGS as much as we can in patients who have advanced disease because of we had an abstract in ASCO this year. Patients who are KRAS wild type, although they represent less than 10% of the patients, but those are the patients where you can find some interesting targetable mutations, NRG, for NRG1, for example, and other mutations. So it is worth doing NGS on all patients.
Maha, how about in prostate cancer? Of course, there are a lot of reasons to consider NGS, you know, in terms of looking for all kinds of things and related immune therapy, targeted therapy, et cetera. But what would you consider, Maha, a minimum in a patient, well, let's just say castrate-resistant metastatic disease, no family history?
Basically, the NCCN guidelines and also the Philadelphia guidelines that was just published in JCO, I think this early June, the really recommendation patients who have metastatic prostate cancer should undergo testing. And the testing, I think, from my perspective, is absolutely, I do both for many reasons. From a therapeutic perspective, for me to prescribe a PARP inhibitor, I don't need it to be germline. If it is somatic and it's actionable, then that's plenty for me. The advantage from doing the germline also at the same time is obviously for counseling, genetic counseling and other family members and, you know, whether it's men or females or males in the family. So my approach is generally the combination of both. One thing I've discovered, and I don't know if this is, I would love to hear from the panelists, is that it's critical to, if you want to find out about germline as you send samples without patient consent, it may not get reported. And so you need to make sure that the patient has been consented for germline testing.
That's a very important point. Hope, what about breast cancer and where do liquid biopsies fit in?
Well, you know, it's actually an area that's being actively explored. There was an interesting presentation at ASCO this year by Nadine Tung from our Translational Breast Cancer Research Consortium, olaparib expanded, and then there's a little bit of data from the Stanford group with talazoparib looking at PARP inhibitors in patients who have alternative germline mutations. So I do agree that you need to have the germline mutation testing because patients who had a PALB2 mutation benefited very much from the use of olaparib in this group. But there's a lot of now emerging data about somatic mutations, and I know that's sort of old hat for the ovarian cancer folks, but for breast cancer where we haven't seen it as well, it seems as though we may be able to detect it more in cell-free DNA and use that as a mechanism to treat patients depending on, you know, we don't really know yet the percentage that you see in the blood and what makes sense, but there are, this is being actively explored and I think is really interesting.
So with this great faculty, we are not going to spend a lot of time going through slides from data. Check out their talks. They go through every one of these trials in detail, but really want to focus on clinical management and sort of clinical pearls from this outstanding group. But we do want to show you some of the scenarios that we posed again to these oncologists, and I think their answers, as always, are very representative of what's happening with the investigator community. So, Ursula, there's like 100 different variations of these things that we present in our surveys. We just picked out a couple of them that we thought would be interesting. So one, a patient with a BRCA germline mutation who has suboptimal debulking surgery. And we flashed on that slide there about bevacizumab, but of course, one of the trials, the Paola study that you discussed in your talk that was presented at ESMO, looked at the combination of bevacizumab and olaparib. So a high-risk patient, that would be a consideration. And then you have a question of, I don't think there's much question about a PARP, but then which one? Because you have two trials where you've seen this in BRCA germline with olaparib and niraparib, different durations of therapy, incidentally, too, 2 versus 3 years. So this is what our group said. We saw a lot of Bev and olaparib in this high-risk situation. More than half of the audience, you can see there's some other answers, a little bit of use of niraparib, but I think a clear message here that at least in the community for a high-risk patient like that, they'd be thinking about not just the PARP inhibitor, but olaparib, I guess because of the trial and the indication, but also Bev. A little bit of difference about whether you give Bev just during the chemo or after. Anyhow, what do you usually do, Ursula, and what do you think about these answers?
So it's really interesting. I really reserve bevacizumab for patients who kind of have more actively growing disease, maybe have ascites and have surgery and then, you know, maybe rapidly develop and reaccumulation of their ascites. You know, GOG-218 had about a 4-month improvement in progression-free survival for the use of Bev with carboplatin and paclitaxel and then using it as maintenance. It did not appear to have the BRCA carriers on that trial, did not seem to have any extra benefit from bevacizumab. So, I tend not to use Bev up front because it has not shown an overall survival benefit. It's a toxic drug, and it has a 4-month improvement in progression-free survival. For this patient, I would choose answer number 3, carboplatin paclitaxel, followed by olaparib for 2 years.
It's funny because as I showed that slide and asked you, I thought to myself, oh yeah, Ursula doesn't use Bev, but or doesn't use it in this situation, but a lot of other people do. The other thing I want to ask you about, Ursula, and we also ask about a situation of optimal debulking, and here you see a lot less Bev, but still, I mean, there are a lot of people who are intrigued with the idea of including Bev. Some were even doing it before the Paola study. But what I really want to ask you about before you get into this case, Ursula, is the issue of the patient who doesn't have a BRCA germline mutation and why probably the answer to do you present a PARP inhibitor every single patient probably is yes. And you might want to comment on the niraparib study, the PRIMA study that looked at those patients, which the olaparib study didn't.
Yeah, so really it's important that the patient have advanced disease, so stage 3-4, and a high-grade tumor, so high-grade serous, high-grade endometrioid, and be responsive. Their cancer should be responsive to chemotherapy. For patients who are BRCA wild type, based upon both germline as well as somatic. So, you know, for all high-grade serous, there's about a 6% incidence of somatic BRCA mutations. So it's important to do somatic mutations as well through NGS. So I have a discussion with the patient, you know, towards the latter half of the 6 cycles. I see how she's doing with the chemotherapy in terms of, you know, bone marrow suppression, neuropathy, et cetera, but mostly around bone marrow suppression, and then start talking to her about a PARP inhibitor in the BRCA wild type. And if the patient is on the fence, then I will use the HRD score. So I will do the myriad HRD score for those patients who are wild type to help make a decision. Although there are problems with the HRD score, just because it's not perfect, and a negative score does not mean that the patient is her cancer is HRP. So it's really to help sometimes guide patients to therapy. But yes, for a patient who's BRCA wild type, who's having a great response to chemotherapy, high-grade serous, high-grade endometrioid, I definitely talk to her about niraparib.
So I see there's some great discussion going on in the chat room. I see a couple questions about MDS. I'm not going to get into that right now in depth. Maybe we'll chat about it later. But there was a paper presented at ASCO from the SOLO2 trial that Ursula discussed in detail in her talk. So I recommend you take a look at that. But I want to kind of get to this case. I always love it when it starts out 85-year-old, particularly with this kind of therapy. So maybe you can just briefly summarize what happened with this patient that I think kind of is becoming the norm nowadays.
Yeah, so she was 85 when she was really originally diagnosed. And you can see from the bottom of the slide has some pretty significant some medical problems, and it was kind of nursing her through each of these decisions. But she went to initial laparoscopy, was found not to be an operable candidate, but an omental biopsy showed high-grade serous carcinoma. And so then she received, I gave her weekly carboplatinum and weekly paclitaxel per the ICON 8 trial, which really did not show any differences amongst how you give the carboplatin paclitaxel. And I thought this way I'd be able to really micromanage her during the treatment. Her CA1-5 dropped nicely after 9 weeks of weekly carbo, weekly paclitaxel. We kind of thought that she had a germline BRCA1 mutation because her one of her family members, one of her daughters, also had one. Then she went to surgery. She had an R0 debulking, so no evidence of cancer at the completion, and only finished up six more weeks of treatment because of just she was so tired. Started her full dose olaparib, 300 twice daily in March 2019, and she's actually done quite well. And she had some mild nausea and some fatigue. She's in an assisted living, pretty high functioning assisted living right now, and really doing well. In fact, I just spoke with her this week. We did a telemedicine visit, and she's a little anemic. Her hemoglobin's around 11.5, but she's doing well. And the plan is for 2 years of olaparib and then to stop.
Any comments on the use of niraparib, particularly? I know maybe you don't necessarily want to do that all that much, Ursula, but in terms of using niraparib in patients who are BRCA wild type and the issue of treating for 3 years.
So I certainly have used niraparib in other patients. And again, I tend to use niraparib for the wild type, BRCA wild type, because it is 3 years, 3 years duration. Olaparib per solo one is 2 years, and it's really, I think, trying to, you know, really maximize benefit from the PARP inhibitor, but really try to keep the risks of MDS and AML as low as possible, in addition to the other toxicities as well.
You know, I was interviewing Katie Moore yesterday and asking her about that, and she was bringing up the fact that these people who, you know, it's a tougher population when you have BRCA wild type, and maybe that's justifying using longer therapy. Well, we could talk a long time about ovarian cancer, and we have in the past, but this is, again, just a little bit of a tasting menu so we can kind of compare notes, so to speak. Let's talk about PARP inhibitors and breast cancer. Hope, we talked a little bit about the issue of genomic evaluation. But we also want to talk about some of the key trials and how they really ended up translating into practice. So this is kind of a weird thing we've been observing in the last couple of years. It's really interesting. Now, here's a question to the audience that'll sort of lead into it. So you have a patient with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, has a germline BRCA mutation. In general, how would you think about using a PARP inhibitor in a patient like that? Would you use it as monotherapy? Or would you use it as maintenance after platinum-based chemo? And Hope, the reason I've always been fascinated by this question is, you know, general medical oncologists are seeing all four of you and beyond, and they hear this story in ovarian cancer. They love it, the idea of platinum followed by PARP maintenance. And then we see people talking about doing that in breast cancer, although as far as I can tell, there's no data on it. So let's see here. Yeah, more than half of the audience says platinum. It makes sense, but just no data. Any comment, Hope?
You know, basically you said it all. We have absolutely no data on this area. And I think it is, you know, if you have a patient who presents with a, you know, sort of a lot of visceral disease, we do see really rapid responses with PARP inhibitors, but, you know, and this dramatic improvement in PFS and response, et cetera, but it doesn't last as long. It doesn't seem, you know, we don't seem to see as much of the tail in our patients. And, you know, some receive prior platinum, but this is patients who are naive to platinum salt. So, you know, the question of whether or not you could maybe delay the development of resistance by treating a patient until you, you know, sort of debulking them and then using maintenance is a really fascinating and question for us. You know, the combination, for example, of PARP inhibitors with hormone therapy and the BRCA2 carriers who have hormone receptor positive disease. What we're going to see, I think, is data that addresses a little bit of the next question, which is, you know, can you use PARP inhibitors as maintenance in combination with an immunotherapy agent, checkpoint inhibitor? And Keylink 009 is looking at induction with gem-carbo and pembrolizumab, and then randomizing to continued chemo pembro versus olaparib pembro. And I think that's a fascinating question that's at least beginning to get to that, but it's all comers with TNBC.
So, but just to clarify, Hope, I'm going to guess you don't use that approach of platinum followed by PARP routinely the way a lot of oncologists do in breast cancer.
I think it depends on the patient and situation. I have used it, and I have given PARP inhibitors with endocrine therapy off-label as well. So I think that, and I, in fact, I have a patient who was supposed to, she has a BRCA1 mutation. She was supposed to have breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer, and ovarian cancer. But after about, 4 months of treating her, they decided, they went back and redid all the markers and decided it was really serious ovarian cancer that I had been treating. In our cancer center. And so then I put her on olaparib maintenance, but I was going to put her on it anyway, even with her breast cancer. She's a fascinating patient who actually presented about a year before with dermatomyositis. And every time I gave her chemo, her dermatomyositis flared dramatically as she released all these tumor proteins. And now her dermatomyositis on olaparib is gone. It's unbelievable. She's on the lowest dose of steroids ever. This is just an unbelievable case. And I hope that she acts like your 85-year-old, Ursula.
So, she could, absolutely.
So we'll take a look at one of Hope's cases just to show you a couple more things, but maybe not talk about them, but just, again, really interesting. So when you ask these oncologists, you got a patient. This is a real situation. It's kind of interesting. You have PD-L1 positive triple negative metastatic disease where the option of giving chemo and an IO, atezolizumab nab, for example. So when we present that, and a lot of people go with that because of the survival benefit, you see that that is the most common answer. But interestingly, when they do use a PARP, there you go again, you see the chemo followed by PARP maintenance. When we ask, okay, same situation, patient has a BRCA germline mutation, metastatic triple negative, now they're PD-L1 negative. And interesting, you see either platinum, chemo followed by PARP or PARP. And again, Hope, I know if I asked 25 investigators what they would do, I think their answer would be single agent PARP, but you tell me.
I think that it's, the usual problem of needing the details of the patient, but depending on how extensive their disease was, I would consider giving a chemo induction and then PARP inhibitor maintenance. In fact, the hardest thing we have to deal with triple negative disease is that you have to be on chemo forever. And we know that if you stop the chemo, and we saw this recently, even with the SWOG trial, looking at, managing the primary tumor, if you took the triple negative patients off their treatment and managed the primary tumor, they actually had a worse outcome. And we've seen that in other randomized trials. So it's very appealing to be able to debulk and then give the PARP inhibitor. However, I think in a patient with, very limited disease, I'd be happy to give the PARP inhibitor up front too, because we don't have any data that the, induction followed by maintenance is a better approach. You certainly get more toxicity with the chemo. So I would say I'm equipoise between the two approaches.
Yeah, so certainly quality of life-wise, you would think it'd be great to avoid chemo. So actually, I didn't realize, because this is actually the same patient that your nurse practitioner presented. We were just talking about it.
And I guess the one...
I'm kind of going back here. So I guess the one thing I noticed that was, we were already talking about, is how she went back and forth between telazoprib and olaparib, trying to find a dose where she could be comfortable. How did it finally play out there, Hope?
Well, I think, this is really dramatic, because I've given both PARP inhibitors quite a bit. And, this patient started on the talazoparib after her radiation to T7, which wasn't so extensive, and ended up needing 2 units of blood every other week. Her hemoglobin would be 6.5, I was 7. It was really very dramatic. And she's a young woman. But she had a phenomenal response. So I changed her to olaparib after dose reducing her quite a bit and still having that problem. And she tolerated the olaparib without any anemia at all, but she had a lot of nausea and vomiting. So then we dose reduced the olaparib, and eventually she actually had progressive disease, and she wanted to try the talazoparib again. She had only moderate anemia with the retry, but her disease really stayed stable and then progressed again. So she ended up then on alpelisib and continued fulvestrant. at the end of this year and is now, and then progressed through that, tolerated the alpelisib very poorly and is now on capecitabine and not tolerating that at all either. So, you know, she is a unique and very unfortunate situation, you know, potentially worse because of the chronic diabetes, although it's very well controlled with a demand pump. So
the thing I love about this case, though, is the fact that, you know, you had this terrible problem with anemia and transfusion with talazoparib, and you didn't, you know, everybody, maybe people go, oh yeah, olaparib anemia, olaparib cytopenias. And here she had a problem with talazoparib, didn't have cytopenias with olaparib, but I guess just emphasizes that class effect type of thought. I'm not going to present your HER2 positive case. People can check out the video that you did on that. But let's move now and talk about pancreatic cancer, a new entry to this field. And with a couple of key trials we want to talk about. We talked about mutation testing. You can see similar to what we talked about before. But one quick question I was curious about, Philip, is whether or not people would use a PARP inhibitor. I think you brought it up in your talk. In a patient who doesn't have metastatic disease, a patient has unresective, locally advanced disease, but with a BRCA germline mutation. And I guess the logic of it, although I don't know if you can actually get it paid for, has the audience agreeing with you. Any comments on that, Philip?
I mean, I would be surprised if you can't get paid for it. But locally advanced unresectable metastatic disease, biologically, there's a lot of overlap. I don't see a reason here why we should be treating it differently. I would treat it like I would treat a patient with metastatic disease, and I would use olaparib in maintenance treatment. Of course, I would be using a platinum-based treatment as a induction, and in fact, most people will be using a platinum-based therapy like FOLFIRINOX in this setting.
So it was interesting, you know, when we first saw the trial data start to come out, I figured everybody was going to kind of jump on this and start doing it. It makes a lot of sense. We're doing to other cancers. But maybe you can comment a little bit about how the trial was done and the question of whether or not, you know, it's better to use olaparib maintenance or chemotherapy maintenance in a patient who gets upfront treatment with chemotherapy for pancreatic cancer.
First of all, the trial was based on simply giving a platinum-based treatment induction combination chemotherapy. It was mostly done with FOLFIRINOX, as you know. And people received at least 4 months of treatment, didn't progress, and then they were randomized to receive the olaparib versus placebo. Now, the issue of the maintenance treatment after FOLFIRINOX is really a very great, I mean, no one has really a good consensus what is the best chemotherapy to maintain the patients with. Is it going to be single agent fluoropyrimidine? Is it going to be FOLFOX, FOLFIRI? No one really has a good handle on it. And in fact, some people, like the Europeans, when they first developed the FOLFIRINOX, there was no maintenance after a set number of months of treatment. If you look at the side effects of the treatment and all that, it does appear that the olaparib, although has side effects, but overall has been well tolerated. And in fact, it would be more biologically worthwhile to try to treat with a drug that fits that patient's biology. And in fact, the olaparib will be, in my opinion, a better choice here because it gives you also the possibility of going back to chemotherapy. It doesn't take it away. And in fact, if you look at the study, when they looked at PFS2, which is the PFS after you bring back chemotherapy, in that group of patients who received the olaparib, they still did better than the patients who received the placebo. So there's some biology interaction here, which, in my opinion, favors the use of maintenance PARP inhibitor.
Maybe you can comment on the case. So you had a 51-year-old young man with a BRCA2 mutation and also a couple people in his family with cancers and BRCA2 mutations. Philip, can you maybe just sort of summarize what happened here?
So a 51-year-old with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, who we treated with FOLFIRINOX because you had in good performance status. And at that point in time when we started the treatment, we did not know that he had what sort of mutation he might have. We hadn't done any testing. But then he had an excellent response to treatment, which was a bit unusual at the time because we were just starting to use the chemotherapy was within like the first round of scans showed an excellent response. And he was of Ashkenazi Jewish descent. So putting 1 + 1 = 2, we went ahead and decided to convince him to have genetic testing, which he was reluctant because he didn't want to know if he was BRCA mutated. And in fact, it turns out to be BRCA2 mutation. That led to a number of things. One, we discussed with him going on maintenance with a PARP inhibitor, in which case he agreed. But also he agreed to pass on the information to his family. And his father, who had pancreatic cancer known at the time, tested and turned out to be BRCA2 positive. So that probably helped a bit. And two of his daughters, he has two daughters, and one of them tested positive to the BRCA2. So the whole thing helped us not only to design the treatment for him, but also to help the family in terms of identifying people at risk in the family.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you think we've had other cases like this, you know, metastatic pancreatic cancer, a terrible disease, it's not curable and barely treatable, you could almost argue, but yet he might have saved his daughter's life by preventing a breast cancer by having been treated. We want to move on and talk about prostate cancer, but I see a question in the chat room, Philip, that I think is interesting. Would there be any benefit in a patient with metastatic pancreatic cancer, status post FOLFIRINOX and GEM-NAB, who has a germline ATM mutation, Philip?
At this point in time, there is some anecdotal evidence. So if I have someone with ATM mutation today, I personally would be using a PARP inhibitor because I've seen some reports and some as I said, anecdotal evidence. There's no study that will prove it, but certainly something which increasingly is becoming there's more agreement that it's worth trying. No one's going to do a randomized trial in ATM mutations, but collectively the evidence so far points towards potential benefit for using it. So I will use it. I mean, this is pancreatic cancer. I will do anything for the patient.
Ursula, what about non-BRCA germline mutations, ATM? There are a whole bunch of them in terms of ovarian cancer. Which are the ones that kind of, from your point of view, are pretty much similar or the same as BRCA?
Yeah, I think the RAD51C, RAD51D, at least from Liz Swisher's kind of analysis in Aerial 2 of other, you know, kind of genes that are going to confer HRD but are non-BRCA. But still, I mean, listening to these answers, I still think that, you know, we use clinical measures of HRD to determine whether or not to use a PARP inhibitor. You know, ovary cancer, we use platinum. So you really do get a sense how that patient's going to respond to a PARP inhibitor. Where the HRD tests are not, you know, you're using that on old tissue, and it's not representative of obviously what's going on in the recurrent setting.
So Maha, let's talk about prostate cancer, and we're going to ask the audience a question, and that question is: at what point would you generally recommend a PARP inhibitor to a patient with metastatic prostate cancer and a germline BRCA mutation? Would you have the patient get one line of hormonal therapy, chemo in addition, or both? And we'll see how the audience responds while they're sort of thinking about it. Maha, can you kind of provide an overview of what we know about PARP inhibitors and pancreatic prostate cancer, and right now kind of where it's fitting in sure. Your algorithm? The audience is saying after one line of therapy, how do you approach it?
So I want to distinguish, first of all, in metastatic prostate cancer, we have disease entities or spaces. One is metastatic castration or hormone-sensitive space. That, at this moment, PARP inhibitors are not indicated in that space. There certainly is the potential for research in this area, but there is no data at this moment. The other space is it's all metastatic, but now it's castration-resistant prostate cancer. Where the FDA approval is for rucaparib and for olaparib is technically in the second line setting. So this is a situation where a patient was on hormone treatment. They might have seen chemo for hormone sensitive disease or AR targeted agents, and now they have progressed despite castrate testosterone with disease progression technically, I don't think it's wrong to give the patient consideration for olaparib, for example, or rucaparib in that setting if they have the right mutations. Having said that, technically, the FDA indication is not in this space. This is in a situation whereby a patient developed castration-resistant disease, received frontline treatment for castration-resistant disease, whether it's chemotherapy or AR-targeted drug, and now they progressed. This is where then it's at the second progression is where the actual space is. We do have clearly clinical trials that are going on in the frontline castration-resistant disease combination trial and single agent trial. But I would say based on the current labels, which I shared in my slides, that would be the specific indication.
So you all are saying that ovaries leading the way and, you know, pancreas and prostate are kind of picking up, breast is sort of in between. I don't know. I think prostate has a couple edges on you all that we haven't heard of. It comes out pretty well in this case. This is really amazing to me, some of the trials that are going on in prostate cancer. Keeping in mind, you know, think about ER-positive breast cancer or hormonal therapy, standard of care. So Hope, we're talking about trials now looking at PARP inhibitors in prostate cancer before getting hormonal therapy, which is sort of unbelievable, at least for metastatic disease. But in any event, Mahao, tell us about this 69-year-old man.
Absolutely. So this gentleman is 69 years old. 12 years ago is when he was diagnosed with his prostate cancer. So then he was in his late 50s. So relatively speaking, younger man. He went through surgery. The standard of care till today is radical prostatectomy with pelvic lymph node dissection, and actually had very bad pathology, pathologic T3 with node positive disease and a Gleason 8, which puts him at a very high risk disease. He basically, within a short period of time, developed metastatic disease in the bone, and bone is the most, bone and lymph node are the two most common sites of metastatic disease, for which androgen deprivation treatment is the standard of care. And by the standards of 2009, pretty much androgen deprivation in the form of castration would be the standard of care.
We should point out that subsequently now people get stuff added onto that.
Oh, we have loads. Absolutely. We have multiple lines of therapy.
Ago.
But that's
2009,
exactly. 2009. This was 11 years ago. We all were kids at the time. So, the gentleman went into a response, and the response, as you can see, can be several years in the setting of prostate cancer, even with metastatic disease. By 2014, he developed PSA rises, and with the castrate testosterone, he technically is now frontline castration-resistant prostate cancer, for which he received Sipuleucel-T, which is an immune therapy, and had some palliative radiation. To cut it short, he elected to kind of had sort of stable disease, and basically PSA was slowly rising, but he elected to kind of hold off on changing treatment because he was asymptomatic. About two years later, he now develops another rising PSA. He undergoes through germline testing, and he's found to have BRCA2 mutation. And so his PSA was constantly rising, and then he was enrolled in one of my trials. And the trial is randomizing patient to AR-targeted therapy or alone or olaparib alone or a combination. And we can chat more about, you know, the rationale for the design. And this is frontline castration-resistant disease. And basically, he went on treatment, responded with olaparib, responded by PSA and imaging, and was on treatment for almost 2 years. And so when you think about that kind of response, it's pretty dramatic in the setting of a castration-resistant situation, much more so than we see normally.
You know, one of the things that's so interesting, though, is, you know, typically this man would have gotten enzalutamide or, you know, abiraterone, and would, you know, very high likelihood of very good response. And yet this trial is not only looking at PARP alone, but I think the third arm is both, right, combined?
Yes, and this is actually stemming from a prior trial that I had done with veliparib. And the surprising thing, so that trial basically was a randomization without preselection, taking patients with frontline metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer. Every patient had to go through a metastatic disease biopsy. And the patients were stratified by the ETS gene fusion status, and this is The only reason we did that is because there was data suggesting that these types of fusions might predispose patients for better response to PARP inhibitor. Surprising to us in that trial, the combo of veliparib and abiraterone was not that much better than abiraterone alone. So veliparib didn't seem to add for the overall population. We had over 70 patients who actually had additional tissue from their tumor biopsies that were part of the prostate cancer stand up to cancer group where we tested their genomics. And surprisingly, the patients who had HRR mutations or DNA damage response defects basically responded better to AR targeted therapy, irrespective of whether they were on the combo or not. And so as we moved forward, we thought we would do it this way because, frankly, if you respond to one treatment, why do you need to get both unless there is better effect? But if there is no better effect, then sequential therapy could be just fine, which is what this trial is trying to answer.
And before Hope comments, you know, also thinking about quality of life, I mean, and androgen deprivation plus, you know, enzalutamide or abiraterone is not necessarily a walk in the park.
Indeed.
Not necessarily going to be, you know, as well tolerated as a PARP inhibitor. But Hope, I just thought it was fascinating that they had this strategy in the trial. Any thoughts about it, Hope? And also moving forward, Hope, of course, we're hearing a lot about combinations, combining hormonal therapy and PARP. You mentioned you already did that. Checkpoint inhibitor and PARP. Any comments about, you know, maybe the optimal way moving forward, Hope?
Well, I mean, I think that this information, prostate cancer has been fascinating, I think, not just in patients who have germline mutations, but even some HRD, et cetera. It's just been really, really interesting. I think that also with prostate cancer, you know, patients won't have received chemotherapy generally in this situation yet. And that's probably a benefit as well, as opposed to our patients with, you know, aggressive triple negative breast cancer, where they will have gotten chemotherapy in the early stage setting. There, you know, immunotherapy is rising in triple negative breast cancer. And we just saw another press release about improvement in PCR rate with atezolizumab after the large pembrolizumab KEYNOTE-522 trial. And I think there's a lot of interest in what to do about patients who maybe aren't having as much of an immune response. And there's a lot of interest in putting PARP inhibitors together with immunotherapy to enhance the immune response through interferon and the STING pathway. And so that's being actively studied in a number of different settings. Where we go to in terms of treating patients in the, you know, early and late stage setting remains to be seen. We obviously are anxiously awaiting the data from the adjuvant Olympia trial, which will give us some information about adjuvant PARP inhibition in higher risk patients. And I think that's going to help also stimulate a whole other group of trials that will look at patients who maybe have HRD. This veliparib recent data about interactions with chemotherapy is fascinating. There are going to be additional studies that look at that as well. In breast cancer, I think the frustrating part for us has been the rapid acquisition of resistance in a large number of patients. And so if some of these strategies can help to delay development of resistance, put the PARP inhibitors earlier in the course of therapy, it will make a big difference, I think, in terms of our use of PARP inhibitors for not just patients with germline mutations, but others as well, looking at somatic mutations in HRD.
Thank you so much to the faculty for tonight. Thank you all for coming.